The best part of school was the journeys in the days when Mr. Bruin drove the school bus. He was a big man with a jolly red face and a heavy moustache. His real name was Broom or something like that. But one day, just after he got the job, a little girl called him Mr. Bruin, and it stuck. From behind, he looked just like a bear, sitting over his steering wheel with an old brown gingery overcoat stretched across his wide shoulders and a bus driver's cap many sizes too small perched on his head. He was quite unlike anybody who'd driven the bus before. "Good morning. This is your driver speaking," he would say in the style of an airline pilot as we rolled along the country roads. "The outside temperature is 17 degrees centigrade. Pressure, 1,031 millibars. Our speed is 30 miles an hour, and our estimated time of arrival, 0850 hours. The trouble was that we often failed to arrive at our estimated time, or even at the time required by the school authorities, because Mr. Bruin could not bring himself to refuse a lift to anybody in need. "You see, headmaster," he explained, "this poor old chap with the gammy leg, in deference to your wish for prompt arrival, made such haste down his garden path that his boot shot off and we were some time searching for it in the nettles." "But, Mr. Bruin, your bus is a school bus. Poor old chaps, by definition, do not qualify as passengers. We'd reach the end of the first hymn again before you arrived." Mr. Bruin looked contrite. The headmaster, a bright and bouncy little man, tried not to be harsh. "I don't insist on the letter of the regulations, but please, Bill, strive for punctuality. The other drivers managed to keep time." Well, they did. And everybody knew why. If you weren't at the road end right on the dot, they simply sailed past, and some, seeing a boy or girl belting along a farm track, would deliberately step on it, leaving people stranded within yards of a pickup point, and on wet or slushy mornings, half drowning them with spray from the wheels. Mr. Bruin waited, and in consequence, we continued to arrive late. Charlie Cupboard's mother wrote in protest, "Dear Headmaster, nothing in this missive should be took as reflecting on Mr. Bruin's bus. Far from it. It's a real pleasure for them, all whipping along to school, whereas at one time you'd have thought they was off to Borstal, and the patience of that man. He is kindness embodied, sitting smoking his pipe while late scholars tumble out of bed, and we have had some with Charlie because his dad, who is thick, overwound the alarm clock and bust the spring, so we are among the worst culprits, and I will not throw stones by mentioning other names, though Fatty Foggan is one, but however, what with one and another, it is seldom the bus arrives on time, which brings me to my point, which is, it says in Charlie's report, he has gaps in his knowledge. Well, he might well have, because of all this arriving late. It's all right if your child is bright, but Charlie's father is thick, as mentioned above. Also, his two brothers. I think it is hereditary. And three thick ones in one house is quite enough, thank you, without Charlie going that way. So, would you please top up the gaps in his knowledge, which the lad is not to blame for, and expostulate with Mr. Bruin. Yours respectfully, Connie Cupboard." A few days later, the headmaster received an official complaint passed on by the Director of Education from a snooping counsellor, Mr. Crammer, who used to pop up over his hedge as we drove by. He made a careful reply. "The new driver has indeed allowed himself to be delayed by pupils who have failed to reach their pickup point in time," he dictated. "But because of his solicitude, the total attendance of pupils from his route has been remarkably high, and they do arrive, comma, albeit tardily, comma, in a cheerful, and one thinks therefore, receptive state of mind," full stop. "The man has a warmth and interest one would like to encounter more often in one's staff, and I should like to quote the case of Arthur James Foggan." Fatty Foggan lived with his grandparents in a cottage up a muddy lane miles from anywhere. He had no pals from round home, he was no good at lessons or games, and even little kids he could have swatted like flies made mock of him. When Mr. Bruin beat the horn, Arthur Foggan's face appeared at his bedroom window, a horrified dumpling. Then he swung the curtains back, and you could hear the bedsprings twang as he leapt under the blankets. "He never comes on Tuesdays because it's woodwork," Joan Briggs explained. He weighs 12 stone, Sam Hamer added. He gave his nail such a belt with the hammer that he split the bench in two and the vice went flying through the window of the music room and demolished Miss Winkle's piano. But the next Tuesday, Fatty Foggan was already in the bus before its usual first point of call, installed in the seat of honour which everybody wanted beside Mr. Bruin. "How have you got there, then?" Joan Briggs demanded. "He come for me early," Fatty replied. "He's going to take me case up."
"This lad, headmaster," Mr. Bruin said, "he's built on the wrong scale for manufacturing tiddling objects like plant pot stands and bookends."
"It's a question of acquiring the facility, Mr. Bruin."
"That's what he has done, haven't you, Arthur?"
"What's that mean?" Fatty Foggan asked.
"You've cobbled up a hen court with your grandad. You've erected a fence of railway sleepers."
"Oh, aye. We've no pressing need in school for hen courts or fences," the headmaster said brightly. "Could he plane the bottom edge of sticking doors?"
"Could you plane the bottom edge of sticking doors?"
"I could plane the bottom edge of sticking doors," Fatty Foggan said.
So, he became an odd job man about the school and a much brighter lad altogether. The headmaster wrote up the case in a small contribution to an educational journal which the director had photocopied and circulated among the members of the education committee as a counterblast to the carping of our enemy, Councillor Cramer. To ensure our punctual arrival, Mr. Bruin announced an earlier start.
"We have arrived late once or twice of yore," he announced when we were all on board, "and the headmaster has had his bottom kicked by higher authority. No, no, don't applaud, please. Mr. Epping is a very reasonable man. We must endeavour to arrive at our ETA of 08:50 hours, and to make sure we do, let's aim for 08:45. From tomorrow morning, everybody be ready 5 minutes earlier."
But this unpopular measure availed us nothing, because with time in hand, Mr. Bruin felt even more free to give unofficial lifts. Mr. Pilchard, the supermarket manager who lived in one village, was a frequent passenger. He was afflicted with a regular cold and an irregular car.
"That's be trouble. Be double trouble," he announced as he climbed on board. "Be car won't start, and be cold won't stop. If you just drop me at the road end..."
"We'll drive you all the way for what it's worth," Mr. Bruin said. "We'll make up the time."
And we did. We dropped Mr. Pilchard off at his shop in town, then back to our route at high speed. We rattled along the straights and we slid round the bends. Hens scattered, old ladies jumped, bullocks stampeded round the fields. Sam Hamer gabbled the pilot's commentary.
"Our speed is 70 miles an hour, and in a few minutes we shall be landing at our destination, the estimable educational establishment of Ernest Epping, M.A., B.Sc. and Bar. We hope you have enjoyed your journey. Please remain in your seats until the engine stops."
We made it in time, day after day, summer and winter. And what's odd, when I look back, I never remember a grey, ordinary day. I remember days of howling gales and falling snow, of still summer mornings when the air shimmered above the radiator, and hard evenings in winter when the frost sparkled round the street lamps. I remember Mr. Bruin's jolly red face reflected in the driving mirror, and the bus belting along, and the children egging him on to an immoderate speed to make good the time lost by his ill-considered acts of kindness. We gave lifts to the postwoman and to the old chap with the gammy leg and his uncle and his uncle's pal and his uncle's pal's pig and the parson and old Mrs. Smallwood, whose ducks we loaded into the boot. We never failed anybody, and we had some desperate races to make up time. Councillor Cramer saw us pass in a blur. He harangued the education committee, whose director spoke to the headmaster, who remonstrated again with Mr. Bruin.
"Endeavouring to arrive promptly and on time," Mr. Bruin explained.
"But you're throwing all caution to the wind. It's a most alarming sight to see pedestrians on all sides leaping for cover as you come rocketing up the street with your tyres smouldering and your windscreen caked with dead flies. See, Mrs. Cupboard writes here, 'It cannot be good for Charlie's head to have his thoughts rattled about like this, and I am very worried about his future.'
What am I to reply, Mr. Bruin? I could well say, have no fears, madam, for Charlie's future. If he continues to travel in Mr. Bruin's bus, he is unlikely to have one. But is that kind? Is that reassuring to the poor woman?
No, headmaster. Mr. Bruin.
Councillor Crammer is a man in whom the exercise of malice for the public good knows no bounds. If you continue to break the regulations, I shall not be able to defend you. Please, observe some discretion.
Sad to say, it was discretion, Mr. Pilchard's discretion, that caused our downfall.
Once more afflicted by his double trouble, he tried to avoid bothering us for a lift by calling out his neighbours, two elderly sisters, to push start his car. They buckled, leaving the car across the narrow road. By the time we'd shoved it clear and taken Mr. Pilchard on board, Mr. Bruin was once again in a race against time. Mr. Pilchard exercised further discretion, first by sliding down below the window so he should be unseen as we passed Councillor Crammer's hedge, then by trying to suppress a sneeze just when we were bouncing over a humpback bridge. He swallowed his false teeth and landed himself into hospital and the local newspaper. "Supermart man hit by treble trouble," the black headline said, above a picture of him sitting up in bed exposing his surgically retrieved choppers in a wide grin. "This driver is irresponsible," Councillor Crammer told the Education Committee. "He has refused to remedy his behaviour and he will have to go." The Director of Education formally called in the headmaster. The headmaster called in Mr. Bruin. Mr. Bruin regretfully accepted the verdict.
"I will have to go, headmaster. You'll only jeopardise your own position if you get any further mixed up in this bickering. So long, Ernest."
The headmaster caught him at the porch. It was a winter afternoon and Fatty Foggham was fitting a storm guard to the door to cover the gap left by his vigorous planing in the summer.
"Mr. Bruin," the headmaster said,
"I'm most willing to go before the committee and state a case."
"Bless you. But I should move on anyway."
"Move on? Where to?" It was only afterwards we realised how little we knew about him. Who he was, where he came from, what he'd done before. He took off the cap that was several sizes too small and presented it to the headmaster.
"Cheerio, Ernest. Good luck."
He passed the dark and empty bus and walked away. The headmaster turned back into school, saying half to himself and half to Fatty Foggan, "Irresponsible. Is that the kind of man you call irresponsible?" And Fatty Foggan, two slow tears on his cheeks, not remotely understanding what the headmaster was asking, replied, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir."